Hello, and welcome to Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. With Databook, we talk to healthcare leaders about technology, innovation, and the transformation of healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll get started in just a moment. In this episode, we talk with Adrian Boise. She's the Chief Medical Officer of Qualtrics, a software company that helps organizations learn more about their customers. She talks about the importance of empathy in patient care, the need to take care of employees, and why hospitals and health systems need to live their values. And she discusses how that will help hospitals financially as well. Well, thank you for joining us today. We're talking with Dr. Adrian Boise, the Chief Medical Officer of Qualtrics. Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, it's great to see you again, Ron.
Yeah, good to see you too. Let's just start with an easy one. Just talk about your role at Qualtrics and the work that you're doing there.
Sure. So I'm Chief Medical Officer at Qualtrics, as you described, and I'm a practicing neurologist taking care of multiple sclerosis patients at the Cleveland Clinic, former Chief Experience Officer there. A big fire in my belly for reducing suffering and creating more joy. And that led me to really think about how can we do that in all industries. So Qualtrics serves about 18,000 brands. And I was really interesting to me to really take what we're doing in healthcare and see if we could infuse empathy in making business more human or humane, as I like to say. And what can healthcare really learn from how these other industries are obsessing about customers?
That seems to be a growing area of interest and concern for healthcare leaders across the country. What are some ways healthcare leaders can improve the patient experience?
Well, I think it starts at the very beginning, which is knowing who you want to be as an organization. I mean, I go to organizations all around the globe and see values on the wall. And I think as healthcare tries to differentiate itself in today's world with a lot of different competitors and a lot of different models of care, you're seeing people double down on experience as a differentiator. So to your point, I think that's why we're getting much more attention around it. And quite frankly, consumers, as we like to call them, have been really talking about they have ease and convenience in nearly every other industry that they don't yet have in healthcare. And I think everybody's a bit weary of that, right? Why are we tolerating it takes 6 months to get a doctor's appointment? That's just unacceptable in any other industry. So I think that's where the attention comes from. And I think it starts with the values of the organization and executive leadership being crystal clear about who do you want to be? And if some of those values on that wall are quality and or empathy and compassion, access, I see sometimes teamwork, then we have to make sure that those values translate to behaviors that we expect of people every day, how we measure ourselves as an organization, and bringing that to life through processes and operations that help people see every day what experience really means. Do we really live those values? And what would that look like if we were an organization that cared deeply about the people within it and the people coming through it? Because I think that fundamentally is the question. We did an employee experience study not too long ago, and it really said that employees are looking for strategic alignment with an organization's value system, which is fascinating. And I think that's about, we aren't different people at home than we are at work, and people are hopefully we're not. And people are looking for that synergy now more than ever, not just for healthcare or their job, but in their life. And to them, some of that I think is about trust. Are you an organization that I want to trust my time with, invest my future with, stay at for the next 10 years? So it's a critically important driver. How do we simply solve it? I think that's a running start.
I was really interested when you're talking about, like, you know, the employee expectations and the employee experience in terms of treating patients better. I had a conversation with somebody at the HIMSS conference a couple of weeks ago who said something really, really interesting and talked, and I'm paraphrasing it, but she basically said it's sort of jarring. Sometimes physicians, healthcare workers can be treated pretty badly by their supervisors and managers, and then they're told, but go out there and be empathetic. And that's not always easy. So obviously we try to take care of our patients as best we can, but if we're not getting treated well, it does sometimes make it harder for us to give our patients the care and empathy that they deserve. I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, you're highlighting really what the literature says, which is why there's been some blowback when we say, oh, go to art therapy or go to yoga, you know, for a better experience. And people are like, really? You know, I'm showing up intrinsically motivated to love on my patients and care for my colleagues. And then I get put in these environments that are very difficult for them to live that truth. And whether it's because they don't have the tools they need or their manager may behave a certain way, you start to see that sort of cognitive dissonance, I think, between who we want to be. They call that moral distress, right? I want to be this, but I have to show up in this environment this way. And that is not sustainable for people, right? That value grind ultimately results in the burnout, which, as you all know, has a variety of outcomes that are very costly, both personally as well as financially for an organization. But to your point, the literature says that this is a systemic problem. This is a problem in the organization. It is not a problem of individual resilience. Now, that's not to say that there aren't things we could do to better fill our own cups. It's simply to say that, especially in healthcare, the intrinsic motivation and value system is pretty oriented in the right direction. And yet we do wind up with managers that may not believe the same things or behaviors in the workplace that begin to erode, I think, that intrinsic drive. And so, I mean, you know, if there is also burnout literature that says if your leader is toxic, you are much more likely to leave the organization, right? It is about that leader or manager is an incredibly important relationship. And at the same time, I would round on the floors during COVID and I would hear nurses say, oh, my leader is always here for me. My leader is why I stay. My leader. So it can be an incredibly powerful force, or it can be an incredibly destructive force. And you and I both know, right? When we keep those leaders in place, when we allow toxic environments like that, that has nothing to do with the values on the wall. And that's devastating to the culture of an organization.
One thing I've heard multiple times from different healthcare workers, healthcare leaders too, for that matter, is there's a growing recognition that if we want to take care of burnout, take care of our people more, we've got to do more than the occasional pizza party to show appreciation. So, what are some concrete ways that healthcare leaders can show their workers that they're valued, they matter, and that they're cared for?
Yeah, well, some of it's the fundamentals. So if we've done the hard work of defining our values and the behaviors and we've crafted the right measurement, then holding some accountability, right? If you're a leader who I've gotten 3 years of feedback on that you're creating a toxic environment, or your people aren't filling out the survey because they're likely afraid of retribution, this should be a flag, right, for an organization. So that's maybe one. Two is listening has to evolve in organizations, right? We've done pulse annual engagement surveys. And even now, I see us pride ourselves that maybe we're going to quarterly. We're in 2023. People are talking about their job and their workplace all the time in all sorts of channels. And so, a modernized listening strategy. It's about pulling in all those different data sources, right? Whether it's structured, I'm asking for your feedback, or it's unstructured, meaning you're talking and I have an opportunity to run analytics on that. And deeply listening for emotion and effort. I think it's too hard for our people out there to show up and be their best selves. And we know that that drives loyalty and trust in the system. And so we have to be willing to listen in ways that we never listened before. And the technology is an enabler of that, right? We can listen all we want. I think some organizations are actually afraid to listen because they don't know what to do with all that input, which is really kind of interesting to think through, right? If we aren't going to act on what we hear, then maybe we should limit the listening posts. And I would argue that in today's day and age, we're certainly in a place where we've got omni-channel data coming in through lots of different places. We could be doing a better job of listening to that throughout an employee life cycle and acting in the moment on it, as opposed to waiting for a, you know, beautifully curated PDF report 6 months later. That time is over. And so the action piece of it is also really important. One of the most effective ways to show people you care is to act on what they say and how they feel. And that, I think, has been lacking for many employees. 92% of employees say that if we get the emotional connection right, they'll stay. And so again, if I say I'm unhappy or I'm in a toxic environment, I'm thinking about leaving, and we don't respond, that person should leave because we're not living our values. So I'm really hammering on values today because I've been thinking a lot about it. And I think listening, understanding, and acting and being willing to hold that emotion is a big part of where people are at right now.
I wanted to go back a little bit, something you said too, in terms of like toxic leaders and the harmful effect they can have on keeping workers, because sometimes you'll hear so-and-so isn't great with people. And yeah, we know they can be really abrasive, but they're so brilliant, we look the other way. And they stay in place even to the detriment of employees. How does a leader, how does executives like kind of start making the balance between the positive contributions and the toxicity? At some point, do you have to say, it doesn't matter if you're brilliant, if you're driving workers away, we've got to make a change?
Yeah, that's a very powerful gesture for organizations. Let me just maybe speak from personal experience, which was an incredibly touching story that I saw in my own career. One was an executive leader, the prior CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, who's shared this story publicly, so I feel comfortable sharing it with you, that he, Dr. Toby Cosgrove, brilliant cardiac surgeon, right, drove mortality rates of pediatric cardiac disease down in his work, and then became CEO. And he had this transformational moment when he was at Harvard Business School, where he gave this great talk about the innovation of the Cleveland Clinic, and a student in the audience named Kara raised her hand and said, you know, all that is great, but I chose not to take my father to the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Cosgrove, because I heard you don't teach empathy. Toby, this mammoth in the field, right? An amazing physician executive leader, was like, what? Like, why are you asking me about that? And his actual word was that he felt floored that this person would care, that that would shape where they decided to take their loved one for care, much less, you know, sort of clinical acumen. And then he had a second experience that really reinforced that for him. And his personal reflection was, I became such a technician of the heart, I forgot it was connected to a human. Think about that, coming from a CEO of an organization who was the top of his game. The second story I want to share with you is when we rolled out communication skills training in my former life, I was asked to work with a physician that had a reputation in the organization that was not, didn't always make people feel good. And I said, well, I'm not going to bring him on as a facilitator for the communication skills course until I have a chance to sit down with him myself. And so I sat down with him, and he had this incredible career, decades of, he was a surgeon as well, decades of caring for people, top of his sort of clinical acumen, lowest complication rates. People came to him from all around the globe. And I said to him, you know, why would you want to participate in training communication skills? Why is this important to you? Because there's some other signals coming in that it's not. And I'd never met this person before. And he burst into tears in my office. This is a 60 some odd year old accomplished surgeon. And he said, you know, Adrian, because it's just hit me at this point in my career, in my life, I have always done what the organization asked me to do, which was the top-notch surgeries and to generate the right RVUs and the right outcomes for patients. And I did that with laser focus for the last several decades of my career. And now I realize I missed a critical piece, which is creating an environment that feels caring for my colleagues and for caring for my patients as humans. And I started crying. It's like we're in this office in this first meeting and we're both crying together. And it was so touching that here's these amazing clinicians who are having a moment about the impact of the environment on how they show up. And I think my answer to you is that you can be great. You can be a great clinician. You can be a great doctor. You can know how to do all the most complex of procedures. But in every single clinician I've met, and we've trained thousands of clinicians all around the globe, every single one of them is deeply looking to have an emotional impact on their patients such that they feel cared for, and they too want to feel cared for. And you nailed it. When they don't, they show up differently. And we know that's true because of contagion studies, right? If my manager isn't kind to me, the next person I interact with, that anger or microaggression or toxicity will spread right through to the next three interactions. And so the same is true of empathy and love, though, right? If we can create an environment that reinforces those traits and those qualities, they will go out into the world and show up differently.
Those are really powerful examples. The one sort of heartening thing I think about as you were explaining these things, like these were leaders and accomplished figures who actually did learn the value of empathy. And they did, even later in their careers, they had that epiphany to realize the importance of empathy and the importance of treating others around them well. So the one heartening takeaway is that it's not too late. You can learn even later in your career, how to treat people better and to be better.
Maybe 2 points there, Ron. One is the literature also, when we track validated scales of empathy across your career, particularly in med students, they found that it crashes during your third year, especially once you hit the floors, right? Now you're in an environment that may not be reinforcing the values all the time that you thought you were going to be doing. So it crashes down. And then it slowly comes up and it recovers late in career, but never to the same levels that you went into it with, which is heartbreaking and fascinating all at the same time. The second thing is the fastest teacher we trained empathy and demonstrated it. And we trained relationship-centered communication skills and found we could improve on validated scales of empathy, patient satisfaction, on CGCAPs and HCAPs, and reduce burnout. But the fastest teacher, but that took a very long time, the fastest teacher is being in the bed or sitting by the bed. Then all of a sudden, my phone used to ring quite a bit, right? My mom is here. I don't like what happened. The doctor didn't look at her. Nobody sat down with her. I don't know what's happening. No one's coming in. And they're just watching that clock on the wall go round and round, which just amplifies all the emotion and fear at the bedside. And so that is a quick, quick teacher. And then last point is simply around the training that we did. What was so interesting about it was I thought we would be teaching communication skills. And instead, what we found were that our people were suffering. And when they were exposed to facilitation techniques that were empathic, they would tell these stories and they would share them with their colleagues. And when it was met with support and empathy, there was a bit of healing that happened. And I think that's why it's so powerful. So if you don't believe in all of that, if you don't believe in empathy or your right brain doesn't think the same way mine does, that's okay. Because now we have nice studies that demonstrate operational and financial impact of getting both right. So when we care in Qualtrics data, when we care for our employees, the experience of the customer or patient is better, and financial return on companies who are very mature in this process is about 2x revenue growth than when it isn't. And that is a compelling argument, not just the right thing to do or the right brain thing to do, but the left brain benefit will come.
That ROI, the return on investment, is probably going to be one that's going to, you know, raise the eyebrows of leaders, but it makes sense, especially as healthcare consumers are starting to get more educated. It seems like, and I'm hearing more and more, that there's a recognition that consumers, patients will go to a system that treats them better. They're not going to continue to go to the provider just because they've gone there for years anymore. The brand loyalty in healthcare may not be what it once was.
Yeah, there's a nice, I have some examples that I've been looking at recently. One is, there was an article published, I think way back in 2018 with Chick-fil-A saying that when there's better engagement, they made more per restaurant than McDonald's and Starbucks and Subway combined. And they're closed on Sunday. And I think we see that when we looked at our own data, there's a very large restaurant chain where they found when they have a better experience for their people, the customers rate their food better. And so these are sort of fascinating nuances that we're starting to, I think, really hear better stories around. And certainly in healthcare, right? It's about, I think, productivity, ratings of patients, profitability, safety, complication rates, culture of safety, absenteeism can all be impacted by a better employee experience. And so paying attention now is really important because the return on that investment is huge.
I wanted to ask, patients are being described more in healthcare as consumers. And obviously healthcare is different from other industries, but you're starting to hear more of a recognition that patients should be treated more like consumers. Is that okay? Because I know sometimes people bristle a little bit when you hear about a patient being described as a consumer. So from your perspective, what is the pro and con of looking at a patient as a consumer?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you did this on purpose, but you're hitting a nerve with me because I saw the same thing that and now there's this debate even at times, do we call patients members or team members or consumers or it's really interesting that we're trying to reframe. Here's my take. Consumers in every other industry know the price of what they're buying, have a choice about where they go, and most of the time aren't fearing for their lives, right? When I get to go choose to the grocery store, I get to choose my green peppers. I see exactly how much it costs, and it's generally an okay experience. In healthcare, however, those same things are not true. And in my mind, until we make them true, you cannot call patients consumers. Because I don't think we've enabled them. I don't think we've given them the same rights they have in every other industry. And there's good reasons for that. And there's not so good reasons for that. So I think when we have an access problem in this country where people aren't seeking care because they can't afford it, that was some research we did earlier this year about the impact of finances on even wanting to access care, or the medical debt that people are taking on to access care, or when you can't get a primary care appointment for 3 to 6 months in a major urban city. That is not, in my mind, we're forcing people into a decision about going somewhere else for their care away from the people who may know them best. And then on the back end, right, I think it's 62% of people don't understand their bill, believe it has a medical error, believe it has an error in the bill itself, and don't trust even, don't know what their insurance is going to pay or not pay. And when you look at patient comments, access and billing and the delays in between are the pain points for patients, not the human beings like the doc and nurse. We're pretty good on the human being touches. It's the bookends in between. So I think until we nail those bookends and really get serious about the best cost transparency we can provide and access that has no walls for our patients, then we can start talking about what we should name them. But the last point there is around the fear and vulnerability, right? I mean, no, there's not a single consumer that wants to come see me as a multiple sclerosis doctor. They don't want my service. They don't want to be told they have MS. They don't want what I have to offer. And that's the starting point. And the fear about the rest of their lives and how it's going to impact them and their family is just stunning and humbling, to be quite honest. And I don't see that in the consumer world. So I think we have to remember, as we talk about making business more human and more humane, this is about addressing the emotional experience that people are having in healthcare, and it's different than any other industry, I would argue.
I know we're rapidly kind of getting to the end of our window. Maybe what final points or takeaways would you like healthcare leaders to be thinking about in terms of taking care of employees and patients?
I think I would leave you with this concept of, I think sometimes it feels very overwhelming for leaders. Where do I start? I could do a ton of things. I think most people, whether we put them in these artificial categories of employees and patients, have very similar values, right? They want to be included in the decisions that impact them. So they want to be co-designing solutions with us. They want to be part of a team. They want to be cared for. They want to feel cared for within the organization. They want things to be easier so that they can show up. And they want to be communicated with or kept safe in their environments. And I think if we focus on some of those core fundamental values for patients and our own people, we'll be in pretty good shape. But moving it from this interpersonal thing, one-on-one, to what real change can I enact tomorrow that could have an impact across the organization? What one thing can I do every day, whether it's listening more, understanding emotion, or talking about it, feels pretty important to me. And I see organizations trying. Mayo years ago made put burnout on the executive scorecard. That's a strong statement. Another organization, they're rolling out a model of communication called iCare. They're baking it into how they operate. When we have mistakes, how we show up and address emotion is critically important. Workplace violence right now, 4 times higher than any other industry. We have to not only address these things from a process and operational standpoint, but anchor them back in the why. We're doing this because we are an organization that puts empathy and safety on the wall, and this is how we're going to live that.
Sounds like some really thoughtful perspective for leaders to be thinking about as they navigate a time when workers are dealing with a lot of burnout, a lot of stress, and they need to. If you want to keep good people, you've got to treat them well. That's really
And sometimes it's yourself too, right? It's not easy for leaders either. And I think the ones that I hear talk about their own story or share a little bit of their vulnerability or where they had a learning moment, we give permission to everybody else to hold that space. And I think that is a one thing everybody can do tomorrow. We can all be chief experience officers if we think that way.
Well, hey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Really enjoyed the conversation. It's definitely a great perspective for leaders, and great to talk to you again.
Oh, so enjoyed it. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you for joining Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive, a brand of MJH Life Sciences. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. For the latest news, analysis, and insights on healthcare, visit our website, chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can follow us on social media on LinkedIn and Twitter. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Thanks again for joining us. Take care.